Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we'll have the second half of our forum for candidates running in the El Cajon City Council race for District 2. Then, hear why Twitter has flagged one of President Trump's COVID-19 tweets as fake news. Statewide, learn why jobs are being lost in California to offshoring and why more California children are lacking health insurance. Now, before you drop off your ballot, be aware that illegal drop-off boxes put up by the Republican Party have been found in Southern California. That's a crime punishable by up to 4 years in prison. Learn how to find official drop-off locations and how to track your ballot if you vote by mail. State health officials have eased the ban on gatherings to allow small get-togethers. Learn the new rules for seeing friends and family on our show today. We'll also have some home safety tips, a look back in time to when Hurricane Kathleen hit our region, and news about community cleanups in Potrero and Acumba Hot Springs. And finally, from 2020 Talk, we'll have the latest on the national election, including how Native Americans are preparing to vote as we celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. So stay tuned for today's edition of East County Magazine's radio show, where East County matters. And now we're back with part two of our El Cajon City Council Candidates Forum for District 4. You can find part one on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. Let's talk about the COVID-19 pandemic a bit. I've got a couple quick questions. I think most of these we can probably do in a minute. But El Cajon previously allocated CARES Act funding to help businesses and renters. If there's any more federal CARES Act funding or similar named relief funds coming available, what would your top priorities be for those funds? Phil, I think you're first on this one.
Perfect. Yeah, so we allocated in the first round of funding almost $1 million for rental relief, utility assistance, and food for seniors, emergency food for seniors. I spoke to Persimmon Apartments manager, and the managers of the senior apartment complex were getting, pulling their money together to get cans, one or two cans of food for their seniors per day. And I get emotional thinking about how bad it's affected it. So we need to continue reaching out to our community partners to see what the need is, reach out to our other cities to see if they're doing anything that we're not doing. And then also we spent about $2 million in CARES Act for business grants so they can rehire employees, so they can save their businesses from shuttering. So all that to say, those are the priorities right there that I've said. Continue doing them and look for other opportunities if they're out there.
Very good. Estella, your views on that?
Yes, I believe I mentioned that earlier when I went on a rampage of, I believe, you know, economically, everyone needs some funding. And yes, the Secures Act has bailed a lot of our cities out. We do need more funding. I know that a lot of cities have spent them on different programs. I've read a lot, you know, since we have received the rental assistance program, it's helped a lot of people, but there's more need than there is funds. Yeah. We get overwhelming calls in regards to that. But I also think that we should have some programs to assist the homelessness again. I know that City of La Mesa did that with the Secures Act. I know that other cities can do that. So I believe that I would assess that and help them as well. Food is important because, you know, our seniors, our low-income, Social Security, fixed-income populations, you know, this is all they – sometimes they have a good meal. That's their meal for the day. I encourage that. And also encourage to also, you know, create some funding for these businesses to stay open again, because I believe in commerce and I believe that, you know, we're all in this together. We have to have our city survive, and the Secures Act, this is exactly what it's for.
Okay, thank you. Dunya, how would you spend any additional CARES Act funding if it becomes available?
I mentioned before that I grew up in a war zone. I grew up in Iraq where we had to, our priority was food and shelter. So I'm totally toward providing food not only for seniors, but for those who are on low income, those who have children that are, you know, that they face a small amount of assistance from the welfare department and food stamp and so forth, providing food not only for them, but also for the people who are needing those food. You know, we have like the homeless people. They don't get a lot of, they get a general relief. They get a small percentage of general relief, that not even enough to for them to rent a room. Like my opponent Phil said, back in the days, he rented a garage for $550. Now you can rent a spot in a room for $500. You can share a room with three or four individuals for $500. So these homeless or the females on the street, there's a lot of females that have been living in the street. We need to target those, and we need to make sure that these are taken care of along with their kids. I'm also targeting toward cleanliness. We need to clean the city. There's a lot of, today I was driving by Mollison and there was a lot of trash on the street. I know I talked to the city hall about a month ago, and they did a campaign a month ago, or they did some kind of work where they went on the street and cleaned all the streets. But now if you drive down Mollison and Main, you see trash everywhere. So I want to locate as well for a program for that, to make the city clean, make it beautiful, make it like the way it used to be. Okay. And I'm sorry, I'm running out of time.
That's all right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate everybody honoring, you know, the time limit so we can get as many of these questions as. We've just got a couple more here. Well, I've got a couple more on COVID. A couple of readers wanted to know, the mayor has indicated he's, of course, concerned about, you know, the mental health aspects and the economic aspects of all the shutdowns. But he actually has said that he doesn't think that the police should have to enforce the COVID-19 mandates on businesses for closures and so forth, or for wearing masks. So can each of you briefly share your views on should those laws be enforced or shouldn't they? Estella, you're first.
That sounds familiar. I've heard that on a national level, and that's why we're in the predicament we're in. I believe that we should go by strict CDC guidelines. I also believe there's data systems that we can implement on a government level, hospital, schools, to monitor and control this pandemic, not just on a county level, but in our city. I believe we should wear masks. That's going to protect us. And also sanitizing stations. I know that I've seen maybe one, but I would like to see more of those around the city. So I'm all about data and science. I'm all about the mask. I'm all about cleaning and sanitizing. I believe the more that we do that, I'm tired of waiting. We've already been into this 8 months now. I mean, yeah. The holidays are coming, and I believe, you know, I want to celebrate. I want to go out, but unfortunately, because we're not responsible, you know, I'm protecting you by wearing a mask. It's not about me, but it's protecting others. So I firmly believe we need to take the CDC guidelines seriously, because this is a health issue, a humane issue. It's not a political issue. It's about our health, and it's about our lives.
Thank you. Dunya, what are your views on?
I totally hate wearing a mask because I have bronchitis and I have a hard time breathing. But I do believe we should follow the procedures of the health guidelines. I believe that education and awareness is a big deal. Not everybody's aware of why we have to wear a mask or why we have to get sanitized, at work or anywhere else. I also believe is if we can open reservations, Indian reservation for casinos, and have a small distance, you know, not the 6 feet distance, why can't we do it at churches? Why can't we do it at work? So as long as the individual, it's all individual act. And I read something that I really liked. It says the only cure to solve the coronavirus is you. And if we are not capable of acting the way we should follow the guidelines, the health guidelines, then nothing's going to stop us from separating, you know, the virus and continuing on having that virus. And again, we do want to live a normal life. I don't feel like I'm living a normal life here, and I want to celebrate as well. And, you know, like Stella said, we're tied on certain things. There's a lot of business owners who can open, and you know, as long as they follow the guidelines, the health guidelines, then why not open? Why not cut down on the budget of collecting unemployment? You know, there's a lot of issues to this.
Thank you. And I just want to put in a little factual interjection here on the casinos that some people don't realize, but they're on tribal land, and so they actually are considered sovereign nations. They do not have to follow the same laws as everybody else. They have, that said, you know, they've made efforts, spent a lot of money on, you know, procedures to try to make it as safe as they can. But we do know there have been some cases, and we've actually put in Public Records Act requests trying to get information to find out, you know, are their operations safe? You know, have their sanitation measures worked, or just how many cases there are? And we're not real sure, but we do know there have been at least some cases out there. Let's see. I didn't mean to jump ahead there. Phil, your thoughts on whether the business closure and masking ordinances should or should not be enforced in El Cajon?
Yeah, so I think what needs to happen is all businesses should be open with the precautions. I mean, closing certain businesses and allowing other businesses to stay open, I don't think is fair, and I think there needs to be equal treatment under the law. And I was talking to a I was walking and talking to some of my neighbors, and I met a nurse, a registered nurse at Sharp Memorial, and she was talking to me about, you know, she's seen a couple of COVID deaths a week, and she's in the ICU. Yeah. And I asked her, you know, you're seeing it every day. How do you feel about opening businesses as long as they have the same precautions as the big box stores? And she said, I think they should be open. You know, she had some comments about restaurants because it poses a different, and bars because you're close and you're talking and things like that.
Yeah, but, you have to, you can't have the mask on when you're eating.
Yeah, so I think that we need to open businesses with precautions. Wear a mask. It's a very tough disease for some people, and for other people, one of my friends, he had COVID. He said he had a common cold that was worse. My other friend, he said it was one of the worst things he's ever gone through in his life. So if you're compromised immune system, you gotta stay at home, make the precautions. I'm out of time, sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, my daughter is a physician assistant, and she works in a COVID-19 ward up in another county. And I know she's having to deal with dying people every single day on those respirators. And her comment to me was, Mom, if everybody would just wear masks for 6 weeks, we'd be done with this. Everything could reopen and we wouldn't have a problem anymore. So for what that's worth, coming from an ICU worker, that was her point of view. Moving on, of course, COVID-19 has negatively impacted the budgets of cities because they have the added cost of addressing things like extra sanitation and so forth, but they also have reduced revenues from sales tax with so many businesses closed or operating at reduced capacity. So what I would like to ask is, if you're the winner of the election, what would your budget priorities for the city be? Not necessarily to address COVID things, but just in general, what would your top priority be in this era of limited funds? Let's see, Phil, you're first.
You broke up there real quick. What are my top priorities for the budget?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So like I think I said in my opening statement, public safety, the majority of our funding of the $77 million that the city has on an annual budget is to police and fire, making sure we're safe and making sure when you need help, people come. Another huge portion of it is, I think it's up to 30 or 40%, is our pension payments, our obligations to our retirees. And that is a massive amount that we have to keep a very close eye on. We have a $40 million reserve that we're planning on padding our payments. The state is requiring us to pay $8 million a year, every year more. So $8 million next year, another $8 million the following year. And so we're going to need that reserve to make sure we don't default. And then we also refinanced our pension payments, bringing it down from, am I out of time? Or is that from the old
one? I didn't state how long we were going to give on this one.
From 7% down to 3.5% over the course of 20 to 30 years. It's going to save us close from $70 million to $133 million over the course of 20 to 30 years. I mean, those are life-changing funds. So we need to keep an eye on our payments to CalPERS. Secondly is our development. We need to make sure that we're getting out of the way of businesses and helping them succeed.
Thank you. Estella, what would your number one budget priority be?
I would like to assess and see what the pension plan deficit is, because I did read a couple of months ago in April in regards to that El Cajon is the number one city that has a huge pension plan deficit, and right now they're going through trying to borrow a bond. So that makes me believe that, you know, something is not balancing. I do want to protect the pension, but there needs to be a reassessment to see how we got to that place, because that is not a good place to be when there is a study done on a state level and we're number one. So that would be number one. And again, you know, reassess, because I do believe in law enforcement. I do believe in our, you know, public safety, but I also believe there should be a balance in the needs. I'd like to know, you know, how much is in that, because I do know that police officers, I believe there was a huge increase this year as well. So I have a lot of questions in regards to those two issues. And again, I would assess what the community needs, because we are serving the community. We're not there to, you know, to expend the budget on where we want to spend it. We're there to serve and meet the needs of the community and see where that allocation needs to go to.
Thank you. Dunya, what would your top budget priority be?
I would seek public safety, crime prevention. I would like to promote education among those who have a felony background, you know, to maybe change a program or create a program where we can do a rehabilitation for them to be independent and they can open their own business and promote investment into the city. So that's my priority.
Thank you very much. Very briefly, I've got, I think, three questions left, and I think we can probably do them in a minute each. But El Cajon has a very high rate of pedestrian deaths. What more can be done to reduce that rate? And, of course, many of these are homeless people, sometimes immigrants that may not speak the language or know the traffic laws. But what can be done to prevent these tragedies? Let's see. I've lost track on that. Estella, you're first.
Very good point. And I believe someone mentioned speed racing, because that happens 24/7. And, you know, I've gone through some streets, not in my district, but other districts that have put speed bumps. And although I don't like them, maybe that would work. But I do believe there needs to be, you know, maybe a slower speed because there is speed racing, and that's very dangerous. So we can, you know, put an ordinance in place on how fast you're allowed to go, but also enforce it. Make these speed racers accountable, because I can't count how many times, you know, it scares me. You know, it could be a child, or, you know, again, you mentioned immigrants that don't know laws and languages, and it is a concern of mine. So I believe, you know, we should address that.
Thank you very much. And let's see. Dunya, your views on how to reduce pedestrian deaths.
This is kind of related to the previous question. That's why I want to promote education. There's a lot of, like my opponent said, there's the car racing. A lot of the Chaldean and the Middle Eastern community here, we have a lot of Middle Eastern. I lived abroad, so I know that they don't have no law enforced. They can drive the way they want to drive. This is causing a lot of accidents, a lot of death toll. There's crime rates, the high crime rates of utilizing drugs and so forth from the, you know, the gangsters that we face, the problems that we have here. I'd like to impose something where the DMV should maybe use a point system. You know, there's another state, I know in the state of Michigan, they use a point system. If you reach a certain amount of points, then they suspend your license. A lot of the Middle Eastern as well, they get their license, not just the Middle East, a lot of the foreigners who don't speak the language, they get their driver license just without knowing or having the knowledge of what's how the driving should be, what's the speed limit, and so forth. They just memorize it, they don't understand it, and they go and take the test. And I've been through that. I've seen a lot of people where they have their driver license, but they don't know what the law is. They don't know how to impose the law. So we need to educate them. We need to make them aware of this.
Very good. Thank you. And Phil, your thoughts on reducing pedestrian deaths in El Cajon?
Yeah, so really quickly, South Magnolia, if you're familiar with it, going all the way south, we just put that on a road diet where it was two lanes going both ways. We brought it down to one lane each way and allowed parking on the side, a bike lane. That slows people down. It allows for pedestrians. I was talking to a resident. There was a weird turn, and three times this resident had a car go into his fence, avoiding accidents. So I talked with the city manager. We came up with a plan. We understood how many people were actually going to that last south section of Magnolia, and we put it on a road diet. There's no more people getting into accidents. We also did it on Washington, going past Second and Hammershaw, going out towards Singing Hills. We put that on a road diet as well. So this is a strategy that we can use to make it more walkable. With regard to street racing, you need to have off hours enforcement. Street races aren't coming during rush hour. They're going on off hours because it's more open. And then punish them to the full extent of the law. That's what we did last time. We impounded their cars. We publicized it on our Twitter and social media accounts. Word spreads, don't come here. So those are just a couple of the tactics that can be used to address it, which we're already implementing.
Thank you very much. I want to ask about hate crimes. In this past week, we've had a couple of very unfortunate incidents in East County. There was vandalism at two churches, a Chaldean and a Syriac church. They were both, I believe, in the unincorporated part of El Cajon, not the city, although, of course, many of the parishioners live in the city, with all kinds of hate symbols, you know, white power and Black Lives Matter, which made no sense, you know, pentagrams, swastikas, very ugly stuff. And then also the second incident involved actually one of my own friends, a board member, who is, happens to be gay and Black and has had a neighbor, you know, where the dog was harassing his dog, running loose. Multiple calls, didn't do any good. And then he got the neighbor on tape, on video, making very ugly homophobic slurs every time he steps out in his front yard now. So what more do you think, do you have any ideas for how to A, reduce hate crimes, and B, maybe do a little better job of holding those accountable who do these kinds of things? And Dunia, let's hear from you first on that.
I'm one of the victims of the hate crimes. I had to escape because I was living in America. So I faced death threats in the Middle East. So that's why I escaped back in August. One of the vandalism that you're talking about, also, that's our church. That's our Chaldean church that happened in Rancho San Diego, where they vandalized it a couple days ago. Hate crimes, it's a major issue that we face, not just on a state level. It's on a federal level as well. My concern is the social media. I know that the Facebook, and there's a lot of they're not taking a proper measurement where they stop this hate crimes. There's a lot of posts that being published. There's a lot of activities that goes on the social media where it promotes the increase of crimes. So that's one. The law enforcement, on the other hand, I had an individual who called me for help about a week ago. His brother is mentally crazy. His brother was threatened to kill somebody in the street. His brother had been, you know, he vandalized, he's been in and out of jail, in and out for past several years. I agreed with the brother, okay, we need to submit him for a mental hospital. And he said, okay, but he refuses to go. So we contacted El Cajon Police Department. The police officer shows up. He said, I can't do nothing. I said, well, he's telling me that he's going to hit a white man and he's going to beat him up to death. Well, he's an adult. Unless he does the act, then we're not going to do nothing. And if he refuses to go, we're not going to take him to the mental hospital. So there should be an assessment on the law enforcement as well, where we need to change some of the policies and the constitutional rights that we have to promote with the society. The society changes all the time, and we need to come up with a plan where we need to take an actual measurement to protect and prevent these crimes. These actual measurements are not being taken. Facebook is another aspect where, you know, you report that there is a hate crime. They don't take it seriously. Oh, they're not violating the community standards. That's all you get from them.
Hi, and this is John, the producer. We are at time, but I do think that that does warrant a follow-up, Miriam. It's up to you whether you want to ask it, because
yeah,
you said that we need to change our constitutional rights, and I'm trying to understand, our viewers might wonder what that is.
The changing the laws of, okay, this is human rights. You know, the incident that I brought up, the police officer said, I can't take him against his will to mental hospital to get help. I can't take him to the hospital. Okay, well, it's violating his human rights. But what if that person is not in a stable mind? He's 5150, the code that they use. Yeah. What if he's not in a stable mind of making the right decision?
These are difficult. Why
leave him unless he commit more crimes?
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
some
you.
Of this, some of this goes to state law and federal, so it's a very thorny. It's a very, very thorny issue.
Yes, it's an authority thing. Yeah, it's a power thing. Yes.
Estella, what's your views on that?
Yes. Fortunately, I've been part of the anti-crime coalition. I work with law enforcement, FBI, and tomorrow we're having a regional hate crime forum. And some of them are how hate spreads online, awareness, and community panel on best practices. So this is an issue that is ongoing because of our systemic racism and our institutionalized racism everywhere, not just here in El Cajon. I have worked with the Southern Poverty Law Center, so we do have some hubs here that have hate groups. So this is a serious issue. I belong to the Hate Coalition. I also formed a 52 organizations to combat hate. We had a forum here in El Cajon Police Department 2 years ago that I assisted with. We had the district attorney and some speakers, and we actually had some victims of hate share their, so I think education is important.
Thank you very much. And Phil, what are your ideas about how to combat hate crimes?
So I know it might sound hard for some people to believe, but when I was in high school, I was chased out of Food for Less with my three friends. I grew up in Santee, I went to Santana, mm-hmm. out of the Santee parking lot because I had my Letterman jacket on and it said Ortiz. And three of my friends were white, and they stood up for me. But these guys were in their 20s. And Chris, David, and Sean, they're still some of my best friends. And I think that's what we need to start doing, is if you see something happening, you need to stand up for your neighbor and say, this has no place in our community. Kick that down the road. Being part of the solution is squashing it right when it happens. Thank you, Estella, for serving on those committees. I don't know of them, but I would love to get involved with them because I've been to St. Peter's numerous times, and it makes my blood boil. Makes me want to create a fund to get a reward out and have these people turn on each other and rat each other out and turn each other in, because I've been dealing with it since I was a kid, and my friends have gotten beat up, and it's gotten better. It really has since I was in high school and grade school, but it's still out there. So I think it starts in the home. It starts in a community, looking out for your neighbors.
Very good. I'd like to hear from each of you what endorsements you have that you're most proud of. Estella, that's your first from you on this.
I have the endorsement of the San Diego Democratic Party, which I'm very proud of, and also the Electrical Workers Union, and also the pro, I forget the title because they changed the title, Southwest Planned Parenthood. So those are the ones that I'm very proud of.
Thank you. Dunya, how about you?
I just want to mention something that I do also, for the previous question, I also work with FBI hand in hand in promoting safety for the hate crimes abroad. So I've been working hand in hand, I'm submitting reports and things like that. And for Phil, St. Peter has been, they remodeled it, took them 2 days to do that because the community stepped up and they pitched in and helped out. So it's already been remodeled, it's already been taken care of. As me being here since August, I wasn't able to, I got a little bit sick and I wasn't able to get a lot of endorsement, but I got an endorsement from our Chaldean organizations, the nonprofit organizations. My commitment was not to do any campaign or not to be sponsored at all. So I'm being endorsed by my job. I'm being endorsed by the community that I have, the Chaldean community. And it's enough, I'm proud enough to say that I'm getting a lot of signatures and endorsement from the community where I live, because I want to meet them hand in hand to make sure that we fulfill their needs.
Very good. That's important. And Phil, how about you? The endorsements that you're most proud of?
You can go to my website, AlexPhilOrtiz.com, for my endorsements. But the one I'm most proud of is my wife's. legitimately, I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing, you know, cleaning up trash on the streets, the all the stuff that I'm doing without her. She's a superhero. We had our daughter 5 months ago, and I'm gone. I'm running my business. I'm campaigning. I'm doing city council, and she is a superhero. And I would not do this without her support, or her unwavering support, because my family comes first. And so she's just an incredible woman. And so thanks, Rach.
Very good. It's time to move on to closing statements. Now I'll give everybody a minute, and I'm going to give you an extra, 15 seconds or so on there to tell us. We've talked about a lot of really serious issues tonight, but I'd like to hear from each of you. What do you think is just the best thing about El Cajon? And let's see, Phil, you went first, so I think we're going to reverse the order here, and we'll have Estella lead off with the closing statements and what you like best about El Cajon.
First of all, I'm very excited to run for City Council District 4, and I seek your vote to ensure broader representation that we have now. What I like about El Cajon is we're very diverse. I embrace all the different languages, cultures that we have. Since I've been here, it's the demographics have changed. I speak probably up to 20 words, Arabic words, and I'm very proud of that. I like that. And I just embrace the diversity, and that's what I represent. And I believe that El Cajon is the best place to live, work, raise a family. And I want to put people first. So I hope that you join me in my efforts. I think El Cajon has the opportunity for residents to own their home, raise their families in safe neighborhoods, and send their children to the best schools possible. So that's what I envision, and that's my goal for El Cajon.
Very good. Thank you so much, Estella. Dunya, could we please have your closing statements and what you love most about El Cajon?
Unlike you, yo estudiar 2 años en la Universidad Español. So I studied 2 years of Spanish here, and I speak Spanish. I speak 4 languages here. I like the diversity as well. I like one thing that El Cajon gave me is when we came abroad from Iraq and we lived here, it gave us the opportunity of expand. It gave us the opportunity of learning new things, new culture, new food, new style, meeting people from different cultural background. My granddaughter, she's half Chaldean, she's quarter Chaldean, quarter American, white, and half Hispanic. And, we love that diversity. We love the idea that El Cajon is the place where I grew up. You know, I spent every memories of my childhood in El Cajon. And that's my thing is, I want to make sure that people who lives here, they're living the way, in the same quality and the standard of other people that should live. And that's what I'd love to see.
Thank you so much, Dunya. And Councilman Ortiz, I guess you'll wrap it up for us tonight. What do you think is the best thing about El Cajon, and what are your closing thoughts for voters?
The best thing about El Cajon is that we have 3 candidates that are SDSU graduates. I'm the third. So either way, we're going to have an Aztec on the dais. No, in all seriousness, I'm not going to refer to Estella or Dunia or Billy as my opponents. I think there's enough division in our country right now. And when crisis starts, and it will happen at some point in El Cajon, whether it's fires that we experience. I was at the shooting at Santana. I know what it's like to see a community together. When a crisis occurs, we're all community leaders. We're going to need to know each other and help each other and coalesce together if crisis happens, and it will happen again. And so I'm thankful for the 3-4 of us and the other candidates that really have an investment in our city. I hope that the voters know that I care.
Very good. I really want to thank all of the candidates for taking the time tonight to come out, to share their views, to give voters in the era of COVID a chance to get to know you. And I think we've had a really good conversation tonight. You know, one of the things about redistricting, the whole goal of it is to make sure that each neighborhood has someone who represents them, and that it isn't just, 5 old white guys sitting up there in a community that's very diverse, that we get women and people of color. So I think one thing that we can definitely predict about this election is that we are going to have some, diversity there representing this neighborhood.
Thank you, Miriam.
So I want to wish all of you good luck. And I want to thank the voters out there, the listeners and viewers who sent in some really great questions this time. And also, again, I want to acknowledge the Facebook Journalism Project for supporting our virtual candidate series. Now, viewers, if you tuned in later, you didn't see all of this, we will be putting a video up in a couple of days on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. It takes a couple of days to process it through Zoom and get it loaded on YouTube, but it will be there, so keep watching. And we will also put it on East County Magazine's Facebook page for you. So with that, I just want to remind everybody to go to sdvote.com. Make sure you're registered to vote. It's a very important election up and down the ballot this time. And if you're not, get registered. And remember to vote. And thank you so much for tuning in and joining us on our East County Magazine Candidate Forum for District 4. Thanks to all of you, and good night.
Good night. Thank you again.
This is Miriam Raftery with a missing persons bulletin. The San Diego County Sheriff is asking for public help to locate 81-year-old Kenneth Zimmerman. He suffers from Alzheimer's disease, and he did not take his blood pressure medicine before leaving home in Descanso Sunday afternoon to get a newspaper. He was last seen at 12:30 p.m. Sunday driving toward Highway 79 from Viejas Boulevard in Descanso in a gold Toyota Tundra pickup truck with license 8E41946. He sometimes frequents businesses in Alpine, as well as the El Cajon Home Depot. He does not have a cell phone with him, according to a bulletin issued by the Pine Valley Sheriff Station. Mr. Zimmerman was last seen wearing a white cowboy hat, a dark blue short-sleeved shirt, and blue jeans. He has white hair and blue eyes. He's 6 feet 2 inches tall, and he weighs about 190 pounds. If you see Mr. Zimmerman or his gold Toyota Tundra pickup truck, please call 911. The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for October the 12th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. President Donald Trump launched the new week with a warning label on his favorite means of communication. Business Insider reports Twitter Sunday added the warning label to a tweet from Trump, who tested positive for the coronavirus and claimed he is no longer contagious. Trump tweeted Sunday that he received a total and complete sign-off from the White House yesterday. Trump said, "That means I can't get it in the tweet, immune, and can't give it." The president added, "Very nice to know." Business Insider notes the tweet contains misleading and potentially harmful information related to COVID-19. It remains accessible because Twitter has determined it may be in the public's interest.
California has lost more jobs to offshoring than any other state during the first 3 years of the Trump administration, according to a new report. Unemployment data shows that from 2017 to 2019, more than 26,000 Californians lost their jobs to offshoring or displacement from imports, a 123% increase over the 3 years before that. Steve Smith with the California Labor Federation says people are really suffering.
Each one of these California jobs actually represents a real person, a real family struggling to make ends meet. And that struggle has only become all the more difficult given the pandemic.
Smith says this means those workers spend less money in the community, tax revenues go down, and inequality gets worse because people of color are hit hardest. The Trump administration says its policies are designed to lower the trade deficit. Will Wilchko with the California Trade Justice Coalition says the administration's policies actually incentivized companies to move production overseas because the 2017 Republican tax bill taxes products made offshore at a much lower rate.
The federal government needs to really get serious about putting the interests of working families at the center of trade negotiations. You know, these trade policies were supposed to put America first, but they actually continued putting corporations first.
Wilsko complains that the U.S.-China trade deal signed in January failed to address abysmal labor rights, forced labor, and weak environmental standards in China.
You know, the things that the U.S. trade representative cared most about was about protecting intellectual property and stopping technology transfer, which are items that large corporations demanded in order to feel even more secure moving their production to China.
Advocates want to see wages lifted here at home and abroad with strong enforcement of internationally recognized labor standards. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
After decades of gains in getting California kids health insurance coverage, the trend has reversed in the first 3 years of the Trump administration, according to a new report. Researchers from the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families found in 2019, 334,000 California children remained uninsured, the third highest number in the country. That's up 11.3% from 3 years earlier. Report co-author Joan Alker with Georgetown notes things went downhill despite a strong economy before the recession.
So we know the situation has gotten worse now. We don't know by how much, but we know it's worse. To know now that we went into the pandemic with the number of uninsured children jumping by the largest annual increase we've seen in a very long time is extremely concerning.
Five California counties are in the top 20 for highest numbers of uninsured children, including Los Angeles, Orange, Riverside, San Bernardino, and San Diego counties. Alker blames the Trump administration's almost nonstop attacks on the Affordable Care Act and the chilling effect of the clampdown on immigration, which she says has fostered a climate of fear among Latino families.
Many of those families are afraid to interact with the government. They're afraid to sign their child up for Medicaid, even though he or she is clearly eligible for public coverage. And so you see a very large jump in the uninsured rate for Latino children.
Mike O'Day with the nonprofit Children Now says health insurance is crucial to kids' success.
What we do know is that children do better when they have health insurance. They do better in school and they do better in life. And so it's really important that children get enrolled in healthcare so that they can access the healthcare services that they need.
California has worked to counteract national policy in several ways. Golden State lawmakers extended Medi-Cal to all children, regardless of immigration status, and increased subsidies to make plans on Covered California more affordable. Covered California also extended its enrollment periods and has funded extra outreach workers to help people sign up. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Miriam Raftery with a missing persons bulletin. The San Diego County Sheriff is asking for public help to locate 81-year-old Kenneth Zimmerman. He suffers from Alzheimer's disease and he did not take his blood pressure medicine before leaving home in Descanso Sunday afternoon to get a newspaper. He was last seen at 12:30 p.m. Sunday driving toward Highway 79 from Viejas Boulevard in Descanso in a gold Toyota Tundra pickup truck with license 8E41946. He sometimes frequents businesses in Alpine, as well as the El Cajon Home Depot. He does not have a cell phone with him, according to a bulletin issued by the Pine Valley Sheriff Station. Mr. Zimmerman was last seen wearing a white cowboy hat, a dark blue short-sleeved shirt, and blue jeans. He has white hair and blue eyes. He's 6 feet 2 inches tall, and he weighs about 190 pounds. If you see Mr. Zimmerman or his gold Toyota Tundra pickup truck, please call 911.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The California Republican Party has been caught putting up illegal boxes labeled official ballot drop-off box across Southern California, the Washington Post reports. Putting up or advertising unauthorized ballot drop-off boxes is actually a felony crime, punishable by up to 4 years in prison. These illegal boxes have popped up at locations ranging from churches to gas stations. Now, San Diego County Registrar of Voters Michael Vu told me today by phone when asked about unauthorized ballot drop-off boxes, we have not heard of any in our county. You can find official ballot drop-off locations in San Diego County at sdvote.com. Just click on the elections information on the right side of the homepage. Only those official boxes are considered secure, according to election officials. Now, if you want contactless drop-off, you can opt for a drive-up drop-off box right in front of the San Diego Registrar of Voters office. And if you prefer to vote in person, you can do that too from October 31st through November 3rd, 4 days this year. There are fewer locations than in the past, with super polling locations that may have longer lines, so make sure you allow some extra time if you do vote in person. The polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. You can also find your polling place at sdvote.com. Now, every California voter has been sent a mail-in ballot this year due to COVID-19. If you decide to mail in your ballot, do so early to allow for any delays in the mail. The very last day to postmark your mail-in ballot is Election Day, November 3rd, and it must be received no later than November 6th. San Diego's Registrar of Voters has set up Track My Ballot so you can make sure your ballot was received and counted. And if you're not yet registered to vote, you can still do that, registering up through October 20th at the Registrar of Voters website, which is sdvote.com.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
One of the hardest aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic and quarantine has been the inability to lawfully visit with friends and family members who aren't in your household. Now, nearly 7 months after the state imposed a ban on gatherings due to COVID-19, the state's Department of Public Health Friday released new rules allowing limited outdoor private gatherings of up to 3 households in private spaces or public areas such as parks, provided social distancing, masks, and other health protections are used. To host an outdoor private gathering, the host should collect names of guests and contact information in case contact tracing becomes necessary. You can have awnings or other shade structures, but at least 3 sides should be open. Gatherings should be limited to 2 hours or less and keep 6 feet between people not in the same household. Be sure seating provides 6 feet in all directions from anybody not in the same household. Guests should wear masks except when they're eating or drinking or taking medications. Avoid self-service or shared food items. Provide food and drinks in single-service containers if you can, or have food and beverages served by somebody wearing a mask and washing or sanitizing their hands frequently. Have some hand sanitizer out for your guests or a place where they can wash hands with soap and water, and yes, they can go inside to use the restroom. Singing, shouting, chanting, and physical exertion are discouraged due to increased droplet and aerosol transmission. If you do these activities, masks and 6 feet of distancing are required. Using a quiet voice is also advised. Instrumental music is allowed, however, if the musician is from one of the 3 households and keeps 6 feet away from everybody else. However, playing wind or mouth instruments, such as trumpet, is discouraged. Anybody with COVID-19 symptoms should not attend a gathering, and if you're at high risk of severe illness from COVID-19, it's strongly recommended that you not attend gatherings, such as senior citizens and those with chronic medical conditions. Now, why are these restrictions in place? Planning scenarios published by the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, estimate that on average, a person with COVID-19 goes on to infect between 2 to 4 more people when there are no preventive measures. For instance, if every infected person spreads the virus to 2 people, and in turn they spread it to 2 more, and so forth, after 10 transmission cycles, one person could be responsible for over 1,000 people contracting the virus. Also, people who are not experiencing any symptoms can still spread COVID-19. We now know that COVID-19 spreads more easily indoors, that activities such as singing or shouting spread it faster, and that wearing masks, practicing social distancing, and washing your hands frequently are still the best ways to prevent spread of the virus and save lives. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Ed Barena for East County Magazine and KNSJ with some important safety tips. On average, 20,000 deaths and 21 million medical visits occur annually, Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna reminds us. Firefighters and paramedics respond to thousands of accidents every day, he says. Chief DiGiovanna, author of the Chief's Corner column on East County Magazine, offers these tips to help prevent accidents in your home. In the bathroom, cleaners should be locked away, out of the reach of children. Medications, scissors, razor blades, and cleaning supplies should be kept in a locked cabinet or out of the reach of children and pets. Non-skid stickers in the tub and shower can prevent slips and falls. Children should not be left unattended in or around the pool. Pool areas should be fenced in with a gate secured with a child-proof safety lock or latch. Electrical safety. Children can stick objects in open sockets and get hurt. Unused electrical outlets must have safety plugs to prevent accidental electrocution from foreign objects being put in the socket. Every home should have a fire extinguisher. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors should be on each floor of the home and tested monthly. Batteries should be changed at least every 6 months or as necessary. A working fire extinguisher must be accessible. Keep paper towels, plastic plates, plastic utensils, and anything other than cooking equipment away from the stove. These items can easily start a fire if left too close to the range. Keep pesticides and cleaners away from children. Store chemicals in a locked cabinet or keep on a high shelf that children cannot reach. Do not spray bug spray or pesticides near a child's toys, since toys tend to go into a child's mouth. In addition, never leave household chemicals unattended. Unfortunately, small children may try to open the products and drink the contents.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jonathan Getz. Community cleanup events are slated in Hakumba and Potrero. The Hakumba event will be on October 17th at the Hakumba Community Park. In Potrero, the event is set for November 21st at Potrero Community Park. Both cleanup events will be held from 8 a.m. until dumpsters are full. In addition, chipping of green waste will be available from 8 a.m. until 1 p.m. at both locations. Residents can bring e-waste such as computers, TVs, phones, or batteries, as well as furniture, box springs, appliances, mattress, and other oversized trash for recycling. The following items will not be accepted: construction materials, large appliances, ammunition, medications, medical waste, explosive or radioactive materials. Due to COVID-19, transport waste in the trunk or in the back bed of an SUV or pickup. Staff will not open vehicle doors to enter the interior. Safe distancing and facial coverings are required. The events are made possible by EDCO, the Real East County Fire Safe Council, and other community organizations.
This is Helen O'Field from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting the Sounds of History on East County Magazine show on KNSJ. Back in 1976, Hurricane Kathleen struck our region, the most powerful tropical cyclone ever to hit San Diego and Imperial counties. With winds up to 90 miles an hour, Hurricane Kathleen dropped a foot of water on Mount Laguna and sent a wall of water 10 feet high and 40 feet wide rushing through the town of Ocotillo in neighboring Imperial Valley, destroying over 70% of the town. Another wave a mile high and 2.5 feet wide swept through Hakumba, demolishing a farmhouse there. The San Diego Union-Tribune said of the Ocotillo nightmare, there was no warning, just a sudden roar. The powerful storm killed 13 people in California and Mexico. It also washed out Interstate 8, crumbling the freeway and destroying a bridge at Meyer Creek, where a 600-foot-wide section of the freeway was wiped out, leaving a gully in its place about 40 feet deep. Eldo Sanders jumped in his truck to try and save people stranded in Painted Gorge out in Imperial Valley after hearing a call for help on his Citizens Band radio. He never made it. His truck was found overturned in mud, and his body was later found buried in a mud bank. Another resident of Ocotillo, John Patrick Riley, refused to evacuate his home. Rescuers from the Ocotillo Volunteer Fire Department found the 63-year-old man's body inside his home, which had flooded. An El Centro resident, William Mina, is believed to have died when his vehicle was swept off the Meyer Creek Bridge on Interstate 8 by a towering wall of water. Flooding and mudslides destroyed three bridges on the San Diego-Arizona Eastern Railway, ultimately leading to abandonment of that railway line. It smashed airplanes at desert airports and turned one plane on its nose in Yuma. A Salt and Sea resort area, Bombay Beach, was completely underwater. Authorities began referring to it as a lake. Most of the 14 cities in Imperial County were utterly inundated. Sheriff's deputies and the Navy airlifted residents out of areas west of El Centro, including an elderly woman trapped when water overflowed her bed. She was saved by sheriff deputies in a flatboat. In San Diego, the storm shut down a Padres game. Out in Imperial Valley, farmers suffered when at least 10,000 acres of sugar beets were wiped out along with many other crops. All routes out of Imperial County except for State Route 111 were shut down all at one time. 80 families were left homeless in Mexicali, and roofs blew off homes 600 miles south of San Diego. Hundreds of homes were destroyed across the region by the powerful storm, which caused $160 million in damage, ranking as one of the worst storms in California history. Alan Zangheim grew up on a ranch in Imperial Valley, and he recalls the flash flood that raced across the desert floor on September 9, 1976. The next morning, he remembers going outside with his dad, believing that the storm had passed. And then, he writes on his website, "We kept noticing some sunlight reflecting off the San Diego Mountains out towards the west. It was like a sparkle. My dad thought it was peculiar, and he said it looks like water. And we listened to the radio shortly thereafter and heard the flash flood warnings. My mom was scared and pretty insistent that we vacate the ranch, and we did. We returned to find out the next morning that a wall of water approximately 10 feet high swept across the Imperial Valley desert floor, wiping out the town of Ocotillo and killing some motorists who were unfortunate enough to be on Interstate 8 at the time the water came through. When we returned to our ranch, it was under 3 feet of water, and my dad's crops were ruined. It was due to this catastrophic incident that we sold our ranch and moved to the San Diego area," Zangheim recalls. He warns that due to the unique geography of Ocotillo, which sits on an alluvial fan below sea level, the same unfortunate events could very well happen again. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
I think that, honestly, the conditions facing Native Americans when they're trying to vote would be shocking to the average American.
That's attorney Jacqueline DeLeon with the Native American Rights Fund. Today is Indigenous Peoples Day, and voting rights groups are ramping up efforts to make sure Native voters can overcome obstacles to the ballot.
For example, just unreasonably long distances to the polls, as far as like 140 miles for in-person voting opportunities. You couple that with the inability for Native Americans to receive ballots at their home because of the lack of mail delivery often. So we have a real perfect storm for a lot of problems for Native Americans casting their ballot.
Arizona, a swing state with contentious elections this year, has 22 reservations. On Navajo Nation, with just one post office every 707 square miles, there's been lengthy mail delays. Four Directions, a Native voting rights group, is part of a lawsuit to allow Arizona ballots to be postmarked by Election Day. Four Directions' O.J. Simmons is also a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota.
You know, we're looking really hard and working with Minnesota tribes, Wisconsin tribes, Michigan tribes, in North Carolina. So we're actually looking at key battleground states.
Including Pennsylvania, where Biden spoke to union members this weekend. And a federal court there ruled against the Trump campaign's attempt to limit Pennsylvania's drop boxes, require signatures to match registration records, and allow non-resident poll watchers at polling places. Suzanne Almeida is with Common Cause Pennsylvania.
So it's no secret, right, that Pennsylvania is very much a target for partisan political actors who are looking to delegitimize and destabilize our elections.
This year has broken records for litigation over voting access, and more is expected. Some will make it to the Supreme Court, one reason Republicans are eager to fill the open seat quickly. The confirmation hearings for Trump nominee Amy Coney Barrett begin today, just over 2 weeks after Trump announced her nomination at what Dr. Fauci has called a, quote, super spreader event. Law professor Eric Siegel with Georgia State University says confirmation hearings have historically gone on during election years, though none just a few weeks from the election itself.
But we can't look at it that way because the Garland maneuverings changed everything. And for the Republican Party to say that President Obama didn't get a pick for a year, basically, but they can rush through this nomination, of course, is hypocritical.
South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, chair of the Judiciary Committee, controls the hearings. His opponent in November, Jamie Harrison, just broke the fundraising record for a Senate candidate in a single quarter, taking in $57 million in the third quarter. The previous record was $38 million. And on Saturday, Trump spoke from the White House balcony to hundreds of supporters dressed in campaign gear and waving flags. His first public appearance since being diagnosed with COVID-19. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producers, John Sepulveda and Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.